Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the philosopher Julian Baggini. He's the author of many books that have arguably helped to bring philosophy to a wider audience, including Do You Think What You Think You Think?, The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten, and The Ego Trick. He's the founding editor of the Philosophy magazine and writes a regular column in the Financial Times with the psychotherapist Antonio Macaro, entitled The Shrink and the Sage. We're going to talk about his latest book, The Virtues of the Table, and how our relationship with food and drink is a great way to explore what it means to be human and also how to live conscientiously. Hello, Julian. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Well, hello, Barry. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, could you begin by telling us a little bit about your background, Julian, and in what ways that might have influenced you to write the book?
Well, I mean, my background is fairly straightforward in the sense that I studied philosophy at university, and then I went on and did a PhD in it, and I really did appreciate that kind of focus a PhD gives you. But I thought that academic life wasn't for me because it does require such a narrow focus. And again, I don't want to decry that. I don't want to say it's a bad thing, but I think it's a bit of a shame that that's kind of the only way in which you can pursue an academic career these days. And I certainly wanted to be broader. So with Jeremy Stangram, I set up the Philosopher's magazine, and I did that for about 13 years. And that was great because it kept me in touch with academic philosophy. I did a lot of interviews with people, commissioned articles. And during that time, I also developed and managed to sort of build a bit of a career writing myself in newspapers and magazines. So, you know, I've had this kind of life of like semi-detachment from academic philosophy, still keeping that link up. And I think really, you know, one of the main reasons perhaps why I'm not an academic is that, you know, fundamentally, I guess that I am interested in these philosophical questions because of how they relate to what are fundamentally existential issues. The purely theoretical ones do interest me to a certain extent, but they're not as interesting as the practical ones. And how this came to food is partly just because I just have an interest in food. I've always been a, well, what would you say? Some people would say a trencherman, and other people would say a greedy pig. But it did strike me, the more I thought about it, that really, you know, it's not a trivial question. Eating is part of everyday life. It's deeply connected to our natures as not just physical, biological beings, but also as, you know, creative, intellectual, social, political creatures as well. And it seemed to me that in its kind of humbleness, thinking about how we're eating had important lessons for how we ought to live.
Okay. Well, could you give us a quick overview of the book and what your main objectives were with it?
Well, I mean, these things go through periods of evolution, and it started out as more of a kind of a disparate collection of things. I thought there were lots of issues related to food. But after a while, it sort of gelled into something I thought was more coherent. And it's called The Virtues of the Table because it's really following a kind of Aristotelian framework. Now, Aristotle was of the view that if you want to live well, what you really have to do is try and cultivate the virtues which are conducive to good living. And by virtues, he means kind of dispositions and habits, really. These are the things which, you know, become deeply ingrained and inform our actions in a sort of almost, in the end, automatic way. But that doesn't mean unthinking way. You have to constantly be monitoring yourself, thinking about these things in order to nurture them along the way. But a lot of the time they become semi-automatic. So the way the book's sort of organized is that I take various themes around food, but each of them exemplifies a certain virtue, which I think is important for living well. Yeah. So it's how, in a sense, our daily interaction with food and the way we relate to food can help cultivate virtues which have a broader importance. And I think, to take a very simple example of that, I think gratitude is a very good one. I mean, I do think gratitude is an extremely important virtue when it comes to living well. And I think the way we relate to our food on a daily basis, I mean, it gives us, you know, three times a day at least, it gives you an opportunity to really cultivate those feelings of gratitude by just simply being aware of the good fortune you have to be able to eat what you eat.
Yeah. I mean, I found the book full of interesting ideas and some real challenges at times to some many commonly held assumptions about, you know, various aspects of food and drink. And I mean, there were 23 chapters altogether, and I'd really love to ask you questions about all of them, but obviously we haven't got time. So if I just sort of select a few that will hopefully give people a taster. So maybe could we start by you telling us a bit about your allotment and the ethos behind that and what you get out of having an allotment?
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I get a lot out of the allotment, let's say, not for free, but subsidised, because it's my partner who does most of the work on the allotment. So I get to enjoy a lot about it without putting in all the toil, although I'm not saying I do nothing. And I have dabbled a little bit in growing at the time, but not much. And it's, you know, people who do grow vegetables and food often become a little bit evangelical about it. Although it's interesting that about 50% of them, a couple of years later, you discover have given it up because it's too much like hard work. But that, in a sense, is an important lesson because, you know, in order to get the rewards of something like an allotment, you do have to be prepared to put work in. And a lot of it isn't pleasant. You know, when it's cold and damp and things aren't growing, and you've got pests and bugs, you know, it takes a real kind of dedication to keep going. But I think for me, one of the things I really appreciate about the allotment is the way it sort of serves as a kind of, how can we call it, a kind of a clock. It's a, you know, we talk about the virtue of seasonality. You know, seasonal food is very trendy and fashionable. You can't go into any restaurant now without them parading their seasonal credentials, and a lot of that is just sort of empty fashion. But I think a genuine attentiveness to the seasons is actually quite important to living well, and I think the reason for that is that it kind of puts us in tune with our environment and what we are. We are finite creatures, we are biological organisms, and we have to live according to a kind of rhythm which is appropriate to that.
Yeah.
And the kind of rhythm that is one which I think avoids the kind of extreme short-termism which you get in a consumer culture, which is the idea that everything must be available now and you enjoy it now, but it's often very empty and it leaves you with nothing. At the same time, I think there's a kind of opposite error, which is to live as though we belonged to an eternal realm, as though we're just kind of biding time until we get to the great hereafter. And I think that's a terrible mistake as well.
Yeah.
So I think the sort of the rhythm and the clock of human life is one that's kind of measured in weeks, months and years. It's not measured in seconds or in eons and millennia. And I think that when you're involved in the growing of vegetables, you very much are aware of the passing of time at the rate at which is appropriate to be aware of the passing of time, if you see what I mean. And I mean, actually, I could go on too much about this, and perhaps I won't, but I think one of the things as well that's important about that is that the transience as well, because I think it's very important to be aware of the transience of things. And of course, you have to be aware of that when you're involved in nature in any way, whether it's growing vegetables or anything else. You're always aware of what's next. I think one of the really interesting things about anyone who attends to nature carefully is how, in a sense, there's the season before and after are always kind of present in some way. I remember being very struck by my partner saying how seeing signs of autumn, and it was like July or something or August, and it, you know, a lot of people say this is so too early to be thinking about autumn, but it isn't actually. You could already see summer retreating, and I think that sense that, you know, what is coming of the change, it keeps you, I think, properly aware of how things never stay the same and things do move on.
Does that piddly little tomato that you get out of your allotment, does that taste nicer than a perfect one that you get from Waitrose?
Do you know? Well, I think that's a huge cliche that things taste better from the garden. Yeah. I think we're quite hard-nosed about that, and I think that some things do Any sort of gardening tips here? I like to throw in some practical tips as well as philosophical ones. I think, if you want things that taste really better, leaves, a lettuce straight from your garden tastes much, much better than anything from a shop. But other things, to be honest, a lot of the time, not necessarily. But it's not about the flavour as such. I think obviously there's a certain pleasure and satisfaction in doing these things. And I don't think you have to kid yourself that the flavour is so much better,
Okay, you mentioned that seasonal, and you also in the book talk about the holy trinity of seasonal, organic, and local, what you call sol, with some reservation. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, okay, so there were three different aspects of that, and they all have different limitations. I think, do I eat a lot of seasonal, organic, and local food? Yes, I do, because I think there are good things about it. But I think, like with so many things in life, I think the mistake people make is to exaggerate the importance of something or to make it clearer cut than it is. So a kind of general rule of thumb becomes a kind of sanctified principle. If you take organics, quite a good example, really, because I'm still quite surprised, to be honest, how many people talk about organic food as though it did have some really special status. I mean, we have to be very clear about that. Organic is a very specific label, essentially, for a certain kind of food production, which abides by certain principles which arose through a series of kind of historical, not accidents as such, but the exact way those principles are does depend on history rather than anything fundamental. And some of those rules are a little bit strange and weird, and some of them are very good. Now, the point is, some people think that organic is kind of like a natural kind term, and that, in a sense, it just means food which is grown in a natural process. And of course, it doesn't mean that at all. In fact, organic standards vary a lot in different countries, and you can even have a form of what, Michael Pollan, the food writer, calls industrial organic, So forget about organic per se. It's not always the best, but the point is, it's often a good thing to buy if you think certain other things are good. So essentially, if you believe that it is good to have a form of agriculture which tries to keep the soil fertile in a way which doesn't rely on applying synthetic manufactured inputs which depend a lot on fossil fuels and are therefore unsustainable, if you think that generally speaking one should minimize the use of things like pesticides and herbicides and other chemicals, I mean, for all these reasons, if you think these are good things, which I generally do, you will find that organic food is often a good example of that. But it doesn't own those virtues at all. There's a lot of food which doesn't have the organic label and is produced in, an equally good way, sometimes even in a better way. So again, if we take animal welfare standards, the organic standards for animal welfare are pretty good. And if you want a simple, to take any kind of label you can find in the supermarket, it is probably the best guarantor of animal welfare you can get. But it is far from perfect, as you can see in things, particularly poultry, actually, because the research on chicken welfare suggests that they, more than free range as such, what they really need are smaller flocks, and they need shelter. They need coverage from the air because they get anxious when they're in big open spaces because they're afraid of predators from the air. And the organic standards, because it's a bureaucracy, they move quite slowly to accommodate this research. And actually, things which don't have the organic standard can go further, quicker. So I mean, that's an example. I could give similar kind of things for other stuff. It's not about being anti. I mean, again, some people, unfortunately, this is perhaps a suitable sort of middle way topic. Well, as soon as you're remotely critical of something, they assume you're diametrically opposed to it. And I'm really not. But I think it's important that we don't that we recognise the faults and flaws in things that we're generally sympathetic to and are open-eyed about them.
Yeah, couldn't agree more, Julian. Just staying with organic a little bit more. Why do you think fair trade is arguably on the rise, but organic on the decline?
That's interesting, actually, because again, seeing how things change in the last 12 months, that's actually, there that has been the trend for a little while, But the last 12 months results have been slightly different, actually. Okay. Fair Trade had a dip for its first time this year after the book was written, so I'm already out of date. And organics went up a little bit. There are all sorts of local factors around that, to be honest. I think in the long run, though, I'm not sure. I think that the organic label has suffered in recent years, primarily because, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is that actually the main reason people buy organic food is the worst reason to buy organic food. They think it's healthier. And actually, you know, there's stacks of evidence on this. And there really is virtually no evidence at all. I'd go as far as there's no good evidence that it's better for you. When you look at specific claims which suggest that it is better, you often find that, again, it's not quite what it seems. And it goes back to that thing about how organic is a good example of a kind of general category. So the concrete example is with milk. So people say, well, organic milk is definitely better for you. They've done the studies. It's got higher quantities of, you know, omega acids and all that, omega oils and things. It's vitamin D. It's much better for you. But it's not because it's organic per se. Actually, it's because the milk which comes from cows which are reared outdoors, eat plenty of grass, and are not being sort of, you know, pumped to produce maximally, their milk is better. And of course, organic milk is generally more of that kind than the alternative. But if you've got a non-organic herd which is still being reared in that way, its milk will be just as nutritious. So I think that as perhaps the health claims have got a little less credible, people haven't bought so much. Also, perhaps people are getting a little bit clever about this and realise that it's not just organic per se. Yeah. Fair Trade, on the other hand, I think Fair Trade has done well because, I would suggest that people can see the rationale for it very clearly, and it's a good rationale, and people are prepared to do it. Now, it's dipped a bit in recent years, but the dip last year is largely accountable for by the fact that the shifts in supermarket power, so the growth of the Aldis and the Lidls and everything, who generally have far fewer fair trade lines compared to places like Sainsbury's, Co-op and Waitrose, which tend to have more. So it's just that shift in buying patterns. And again, this is a bit depressing in a way, because what it kind of suggests is, for all people's good intentions and motives, at the end of the day, a lot of what people buy will depend upon what happens to be convenient for them. And if they're on a bit of an economy drive, and as a result they're going to Lidl and everything more, some of their fair trade purchases will go by the way.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Well, we were talking a little bit about animals there. You were once pretty much, arguably, a vegetarian, but now describe yourself as a compassionate omnivore and an advocate of what you call animal welfareism. This is obviously a huge topic, but could you just give us a quick outline, if that's possible?
the quick outline. Well, okay, I faced ultimately the dilemma that most, if you're a vegetarian but not a vegan.
I'm a vegan, by the way.
You're a vegan. Yeah. Well, good for you, in the sense that you're have the virtue of greater consistency, let's put it that way. Than a lot of the vegetarians. Yeah. So as you all know, I don't know what stage you went by it. Did you go straight to veganism?
Or no, I started off as a veggie for years, and then I sort of my resolve went a bit, and then I came back round. I would describe myself as a non-absolute vegan as well, because I think I would be okay with a world of compassionate omnivorism if that meant we just ate significantly less animal products.
It's interesting to say that, because there are lots of different reasons why people are vegan or vegetarian. But if you're on ethical grounds, the problem an ethical vegetarian has, which they realise pretty quickly, comes around dairy products. Yeah. Because you can't get around the fact that the dairy industry relies upon the killing of animals, because the cows calve. They have to have calves. And what do you do with the bald calves, the males? They're surplus to requirements. A lot of the time, historically, they've just been killed at birth and tossed aside. Yeah. Actually, as I understand it, they are used a little bit more now. There's not much market for the pink veal, I mean, as they call it, which is, you know, the meat, but, you know, it will at least go into sort of pet food and things. But the fact of the matter is, animals have to die for that. The second thing is, in terms of suffering. Now, if your concern is animal suffering, and I think animal suffering is more important than animal death, You know, I don't think death is the big issue. If you're interested in animal suffering, then if you are going to be vegetarian or vegan, at the very least, you should be very much conscientious about what kind of dairy you have. And I think it's quite, I think it's just wrong-headed when people say, I want to have a vegetarian cheese, which doesn't contain that tiny bit of rennet, which is the animal product, but the milk is coming from an intensively reared cow, which has a miserable life, kept indoors a lot of the time, milks twice a day. The lameness in the dairy herd is extremely high. I think it's between a quarter and a third of the dairy herd is lame because, you know, they're carrying so much weight. So I kind of think you're kind of forced to really bite the bullet there and say, I've really either got to be vegan or I've got to kind of rethink this. And I went through that and I thought, well, look, for me, it is about suffering. It's not about pain. Not about death. It's not about killing, because I don't really have a problem. I think the animals, you know, it varies, but the kind of animals that we eat routinely, I think there's no reason why they should feel unnecessary pain just for our benefit. But they don't have, like, you know, life projects, ambitions for when they're older. As long as they live well, it's not a great tragedy when they are killed, and they're killed humanely. And I don't think even, you know, people say, yes, but there's always going to be some pain. Well, of course there is, but there's some pain in the life of any animal. There's a pain in the life of the human animal. Actually, if they're looked after well in a good herd, chances are that they're going to have less suffering than a lot of their wilder cousins. So it seemed to me that all my reasons for wanting to be compassionate towards animals and to reduce their suffering was compatible. I could do one of two things. I could either stop eating animals altogether, and that would be a help. But if I'm going to have any animal products whatsoever, it made no sense to sort of, like, you know, have things like milk and cheese and eggs, but never eat meat. And so I kind of came out to the view that actually, no, I would eat a certain amount of meat. And I don't eat a great deal. I mean, I agree with you that there are lots of reasons why we ought to be eating less, fewer animals, for environmental issues in particular. I mean, from a health point of view, the average Westerner eats too much as well. So I definitely think we should be eating less. But I really don't think that the kind of moderate consumption of animal when reared well is problematic. And I think in terms of if you're interested in promoting animal welfare, there is a sense in which becoming a vegetarian or a vegan is a very good way of making a stand and getting it out. But I guess I'm kind of a little bit dispirited by how people who don't make that choice, how few of them make any effort at all to really make sure the meat they source is well, they eat is well sourced. And again, people have a sort of strange double standards on this, because there are actually a lot of people, if they're going to a supermarket or a butcher, will look out for the free range or everything. But, you know, I've been in restaurants with people, and I suppose perhaps more often with people I don't know because of, like, book festivals and things. And, you know, I think I'm the only person I've ever heard ask a waiter about, you know, if they know anything about where the meat comes from. You know, people even just order it. And I think that if we should take that responsibility much more seriously, and I think people should be asking many tougher questions about where their animal products are coming from.
Yeah, I agree with that as well, Jimmy. I suppose for me, it's I'm just trying to make a small challenge in a small way to sort of the degree of indifference and lack of identification that many people, as you say, many people have from where these products are coming from. But, you know, if everyone was more compassionate, and also if there was more of a recognition that, I'm not saying in every situation, but if there's more recognition that it's very inefficient in many ways to eat meat. I mean, you did say in the book that there is obviously some land that is not open to arable produce, and that would make sense to have animals on that. But I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that we could feed the planet more efficiently if we ate less meat, and I suppose that's my stance.
Well, absolutely. Less is the key point, not zero, because you've got, say, land which isn't suitable for arable production, which animals can graze on. You've also got the possibility, and again, we don't do this enough with things like chickens and pigs and everything, of being able to feed them sort of byproducts and waste even, you know. and which again extremely efficient, much more efficient than chucking that waste away or turning it into compost. I mean, obviously, when we're not really what we're not doing at the moment, and I'm sure we won't have time to, is to go into the fundamental issue of, you know, if people think it is fundamentally wrong to use animals for our own ends at all. Of course, this doesn't address the issue. But as I say, I take it, I mean, I, for present purposes, just have to take it as a starting point that if the ethical concern is reducing suffering and the environmental issues, then it's about how much meat and how it's produced, which really matters. And in terms of raising awareness and moving things on, again, I kind of think, I mean, as much as I kind of, I do respect vegetarians and vegans. I mean, for some vegetarians might be offended by the book because I talk about their inconsistency, but I do also say that their kind of sincere attempt to have a positive impact is much preferable to the vast indifference of other people. So I'm not decrying that. But in terms of the effectiveness of being able to change things, I think ultimately, you know, the levels of vegetarianism in the countries I've been has been pretty stable for quite a long time, actually. I think most people are just not going to be persuaded by it. And the opportunities of wholesale change are for changing the habits of meat eaters, not turning meat eaters into vegetarians. And I think an organisation like Compassion in World Farming shows actually you can have much more success with that than people might think. You know, they've done it when McDonald's, it depends on the animal product as to how good their record is, but they went over to entirely free range eggs quite a long time ago. They went over to organic milk for their teas and coffees and things quite a long time ago. And with all these things, I met someone from McDonald's, you know, it's about customer demand. You know, the idea that, I mean, some people have this weird idea that companies like McDonald's simply have an interest in sort of like creating as much animal suffering as possible. But it's for them, it's a very easy choice. As soon as customers say, we want this and we're prepared to pay how much it costs for it, they will make that switch. But all the time people want chicken breast at like 99p a portion or something, then they're not going to switch from using broiler chickens to free-range chickens.
As we said earlier, this is a subject we could just talk about for
Yeah.
ages, really. But anyway, let's move on. Can we talk about objectivity and discernment? You appear persuaded by the philosopher Thomas Nagel's suggestion that the distinction between our more subjective and more objective views is again really a matter of degree. Arguably, a more incremental quotidian usage, such as, you know, come on, be more objective, rather than objectivity being a God's eye view. How does this apply to food and drink?
Okay, well, okay, so that's quite interesting. So that, just to get clear on that distinction, I think your summary is right and fair. It's the idea that if you imagine the objective to be this, you know, absolutely neutral, impartial, all-encompassing perspective, it's kind of not even necessarily coherent, really, because there has to be any perspective has to be kind of from somewhere. You know, Nagel called his book The View from Nowhere, and that is a contradiction. And yet that is kind of the assumption people make about objectivity. But his alternative is to think that no, objectivity is a matter of degree. And what really happens is the more you're able to adopt a perspective which depends less on your own particular situation, particular knowledge, senses, whatever it is, the more objective your viewpoint becomes. So we strive for greater objectivity without deluding ourselves that we can achieve full objectivity. Now, how does that relate to food and discernment? Well, I think it's just that it's quite a good example in a way, because when people talk about, oh, everything's subjective and everything, you know, with ethics and morality, a lot of people say that. And, you know, it seems like credible to some people, but maybe not obvious. When it comes to things like music, perhaps, people are often persuaded by that. But even then, not entirely, because, you know, people would say, okay, well, I do accept that, you know, me bashing out tunelessly on a guitar, which I can't even play, is not as good as, you know, Jimi Hendrix or something. When it comes to food, I think people would almost think it's just obvious that it's, of course it's subjective. There can be no objectivity. Everything is just a matter of taste, you know, in this case, literally taste. And I think that's kind of wrong, and we shouldn't be afraid of it. And The key thing here is to recognise that there's a difference between preference and a judgment of quality. And we don't really have too many problems making that distinction in other aspects of aesthetic judgment. So I think even with music, to be honest, I think people will acknowledge, you know, it's a really trashy song, but I like it. Or, you know, yes, Mahler is a fantastic composer, but he just leaves me cold. Perhaps I'm not sophisticated enough for it. But I think we should be prepared to admit the same when it comes to food and drink. I think there is a kind of level of discernment, and I think wine's a good example of this. Now, because there's so much snobbery around wine, I think people are often reluctant to admit this. But I think if you know someone, or if you are someone who really is into wine and understands it, and even if you just try for a while, if you have a tasting with someone who knows what they're talking about, you will recognise that, yes, actually, you compare a really good wine with a kind of everyday wine you might drink at home, then, yes, there are layers of complexity and sophistication to the flavour of that wine, which are greater than the kind of big smack in the mouth that you might get from a cheaper wine. Now, the fact that not everyone actually prefers that more complex wine, the fact actually that some of these more complex flavours you may take a dislike to, is besides the point. Is nevertheless, there is a sense in which there are real qualities to that wine which someone of discernment can appreciate, and in a way we can all learn to appreciate them a bit more. So I think, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of the idea that some people's sort of palates and levels of discernment are better trained than our own. I'm not a connoisseur in that way at all, actually. It's strange doing this book because people often sort of say, oh, you must be a gourmand. And actually I go, well, no, not at all. Because if you actually read the book, you can see that I'm concerned with good everyday eating and habits and virtues.
Yeah.
And that's different to connoisseurship. So it's, and I think actually detaching the idea of connoisseurship from what I think is the good and appropriate appreciation of everyday foods is very useful as well, actually, because you don't have to become a foodie in that strange sense to really, I think, you know, get more out of the food you eat every day and appreciate it in useful ways.
To me, it's a very empowering idea as well, in a way, because, okay, you have to hold these ideas or values or the decisions you make provisionally, but nevertheless, then arguably one decision or value can then be better in the other, rather than sort of falling into sort of relativism or being absolute about things.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yes, one doesn't have to be completely relativist about it. And again, having that openness to possibilities, I think it's very important and empowering and exciting. You know, if everything is, oh, we know, I just know what I like and that's the end of the story, well, there's nothing really to explore and investigate. And I think it's quite interesting, you know, when you eat something new or different, or someone makes you attend to something in a different way, it enriches your experience of the world. So wine's another good example. I haven't become a connoisseur, but just through a little few brushes with people who really know about their wine, I have tried to become a bit more attentive. And it does, you know, it means that simple everyday things take on an extra richness and complexity. And in a sense, that is important to the living of a good life, because I think, you know, the texture of daily life, for want of a better phrase, is important to living well. It's not just about grand achievements or, you know, ultimate goals, which in the end only sort of like fade to dust anyway.
I think in the book you appear very suspicious in general of the strong dualistic current in Western philosophy, especially when it sort of keeps body and mind apart and failing to account for what you call, I'll see if I can get the pronunciation right here, Julian, suchosomatic unity.
I mean, I didn't really want to come up with a neologism, but I found that the existing terminology didn't really work. People say psychosomatic, but I think psychosomatic in itself kind of has somewhat dualistic associations, as though, yeah, it's mind and mind-body in that separate way. Suke is like the Greek term for soul, but it doesn't mean a separate immaterial part. Soul in Aristotle is generally understood to be, it's a kind of, if you like, the life principle of something. So you're matter. You are just matter fundamentally. You're made up of stuff. But because of the way that stuff is arranged, it sort of gives life to what you are, and a particular form of life to what you are. And that is kind of what's called sort of soul. And of course, mind, mentality, consciousness are all part of that. So, yeah, I think there is this dualistic way of thinking which separates mind and body, which, you know, and again, it's one of those strange things, isn't it, that you hardly find anyone these days who would admit to being a dualist. Most people think it's kind of a bit balmy to think there are these two substances, but dualistic ways of thinking still permeate as a lot. And I think in philosophy, for example, I mean, again, the minority are official dualists for sure, but nonetheless, if you look at the practice of philosophy and what non-dualistic philosophers like Aristotle have said about the good life, they kind of put in top place the life of the mind, the intellect, and the body is just sort of relegated to second place.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, well, you know, we ought to do a bit better than that. And I think actually one of the things in the book which I personally found most interesting, and in a sense I feel I should try to make more of, because it's not something I've heard said so much, but is when I was thinking about pleasure. And, you know, people have this distinction of higher and lower pleasures from John Stuart Mill. You know, the higher pleasures are the ones of the intellect and of music and art, and the lower pleasures are one of the body. And again, that's a kind of a, there's no metaphysical, ontological dualism there, but there's a kind of other dualism going on. And I thought, well, actually, I think there is something to be said for the fact that some pleasures are higher and lower than others. But I don't think the way to draw that distinction is in terms of, you know, those which are more intellectual or more physical. I think it's rather the way in which we relate to those pleasures, how it's the how we appreciate them rather than the where they reside.
Yeah.
So in that sense, for example, if you attend to the pleasures of the, enjoy the pleasures of the flesh in a fully human way, being fully appreciative of them, attentive to them, you know, seeing them as part of this transient life, then they can be higher pleasures than, let's say, what traditionally considered the more intellectual pleasures, which are enjoyed in a more superficial way. You know, so simple example might be this, that you sit down to eat something and you fully appreciate it, understanding where it comes from and so forth. That's a higher pleasure than someone reading Shakespeare and not really understanding a word or not paying attention to it.
Right. Another thing I really liked about the book was that at the end of each chapter, you had a loose suggestion about how to cook something rather than a recipe. What was your rationale behind that?
Oh, yeah, that was quite... I quite like this one. Again, it sounds a bit big-headed to say I quite like it when it's in my own book. But, yeah, I wanted to have something practical at the end of each chapter because, you know, I do want to sort of take this back into daily life. It's a book about the practice of daily life, and I thought it'd be good to sort of give people something they could do in their own homes, which would give them some way of thinking about what's been discussed in a practical way.
Yeah.
Now, why are they not recipes as such, though? Well, that's because I have a kind of a motto, and it's that there is no algorithm. And this applies to lots of things. Of course, there are algorithms for some things, but usually not for the things that matter most importantly in life, in particular when it comes to ethics and living well. And rather, we have to rely on judgment. And judgment, that's not just untutored subjective preference. It's far from it, actually. Good judgment requires experience and thinking and working things through. But it's not reducible to a little formula. And I think you see that a lot in moral philosophy in particular. I think a lot of people would like there to be some kind of moral calculus, such as a utilitarian one, where you could just work out infallibly whether something was right or wrong.
Yeah.
But the world's too complex for that. You always have to be sensitive to context and so forth. And I think that increasingly, I think the way the modern world is structured is kind of discouraging us from developing what, you know, Aristotle called practical wisdom, which is that form of like intellectual judgment. and instead replaces that with various forms of algorithms. So if you're employing someone for a job, for example, you're given a checklist and you have to tick candidates off against the criteria, and the one with the highest points total wins. Whereas actually we all know that the ideal person for the job is often it's a sort of strange combination of factors which don't necessarily reduce to that. Doctors, police forces, all sorts of people are basically being now required to make their decisions on the basis of these kind of algorithms or check sheets rather than apply their professional judgment. So yeah, the kitchen is compared to a lot of those things, a comparatively trivial way of exemplifying that. But you know, we have this problem. People acknowledge there's a problem, which people aren't cooking as much as they should be, because actually there's quite good evidence that the greatest predictor of the healthiness of a diet is simply how much is cooked from scratch at home. Really? And apparently that cuts across income, education, and everything. You know, that it really is the greatest factor. But people have lost a lot of their cooking skills. And people think, well, okay, give them recipes then, like Jamie Oliver tried to do with the good people of Rotherham. But the problem with recipes is that, you know, people become hopelessly dependent upon the algorithm in front of them. So, you know, they go, oh, yeah, they look at it and they go, oh, it says 3 large potatoes, I've only got 2. Ah, I can't do it. And you know, I don't want to take the mick out of it, but the point is, it's not their fault. They haven't been encouraged to think about cooking in that slightly freer way where you just use your judgment. You can improvise a bit. Improvisation in cooking is not the preserve of the top people as it might be thought of in music. Actually, I'm going to come back to that in a minute because this is quite an interesting one.
Yeah.
So I'm encouraging people to sort of like get an idea of using their judgment, not relying on things, taking responsibility. And this is actually very liberating, because once you start doing that, once you take that approach to cooking, you find that you're much, much more flexible. And of course you'll have failures. We all do, but that doesn't matter, because actually even a failure when you're cooking from good stuff with good ingredients at home is normally pretty good. Now, so there's a little aside here I do want to try and get in, because in the book I said it's not like music, where improvisation is actually something which you can only do when you have been greatly trained. You know, you first learn all your scales and then you improvise. You can improvise from day one. I was quite encouraged and delighted to discover, after having finished the book, that there's a lot of interest in this way of teaching music in Naples. And I can't remember the 18th century, 19th century, I can't remember, but there was a whole flourishing of classical music in Naples, and they used this method of teaching. And interestingly enough, it required improvisation from a very, very early stage. You know, it wasn't something that this is what they did. They gave people a little phrase or a little chord, whatever it might be, and they encouraged people to improvise around that right from the beginning. And there's been revived interest in this, and there are people now trying to revive it as a method of teaching here. So early days, but I was quite encouraged that maybe, you know, even with something like music, that the ability to kind of encourage people to kind of be more creative and improvisational in what they do is actually potentially important for learning in maybe, who knows, maybe most domains, if not all.
I agree there, and that's again another topic about education. I think we make people really jump through hoops these days, don't we?
And yes.
Next question, Julian. What's in your mind is the difference between seize the day and mindful appreciation?
Ah, right. Yeah, yeah. See, I've always been very unhappy with seize the day as a phrase because, well, a couple of reasons. If you think about it, you can't really seize it. That's the whole point. It's constantly moving. It's like trying to catch a slippery pig. And seize is also, there's that kind of desperation about it, isn't there? That urgency. And I think that the problem with seize the day, if it's understood in the wrong way, which I think is the way it's encouraged to think about it by the very phrasing, is that what it encourages is, you know, what in Buddhism is called grasping, you know, grasping and seizing is similar words, aren't they? That idea that what you're trying to do is you're sort of like trying to fight the passing of time by trying to hold on to and grasp onto every little pleasure or experience that comes your way, in a way, it is ultimately, though, going to leave you unsatisfied because, as I say, you can't hold it, you can't grasp it, it's going to go. And I think, you know, there's that great dissatisfaction which comes from people who try too hard to make the most of each day by simply focusing too much on the moment in the wrong way. So there's a poem of Dorothy Parker's which I tend to repeat too much. I never get the exact words right, but it goes something like, you know, let's laugh, dance and sing and drink and love the whole night through, for tomorrow we shall surely die, but alas, we never do.
Yeah,
and it's that lovely sense that, you know, when you're living in that kind of way, the very problem is that you do your best to enjoy yourself, and then the next day you wake up potentially with a hangover, potentially with the wrong person or indigestion, whatever it is, and you've got to start the whole treadmill again. Now, I think there's another sense of mindful appreciation. It's not a million miles from that, actually, from Caesar, but it's not about trying to seize anything. It's the exact opposite. And again, you know, I think that I know that middle way philosophy has a lot of inspiration from Buddhism. And I think, you know, it's found there, I think its source is there. It's that idea of being able to really appreciate and enjoy and attend to the present moment and take pleasure from it, but in a way which at the same time is accepting its passing. And I think that's something that's very, very possible to do. Interestingly enough, one of the people I spoke to when writing the book was a Buddhist abbot, monastery from the Thai forest tradition. And I was asking them why they're quite austere about their eating. And I say, well, why not, you know, why not perhaps enjoy it a bit more, you know? And from his point of view, he was saying he felt that, you know, if you give in to that kind of stuff, if you go, this is tasty, you're kind of almost inevitably going to end up having that grasping attitude. It's good, so I want more, I want it again, etc., etc. And he thought that was unhealthy. So from his point of view, and I don't know exactly how indicative this is of all Buddhists, but I think it's quite typical. Yeah. The idea is that you should really try and minimize your kind of appreciation of such things because it's kind of bound to encourage the wrong kind of grasping and holding on. Well, the problem I have with that is that I just simply don't buy the idea that there's something higher sort of to come or to focus on, really. I think we have to sort of live very fully in the material world that we were evolved to live in. But I disagree that this grasping is unavoidable, or a little bit of it might be, but it's copable with, I think. So I think the kind of attitude we should try and cultivate towards pleasures, good pleasures, is one where we don't try and sort of put them aside or overcome them and think of them as base and we're above that and we should focus on intellectual things. We should try to enjoy them in the appropriate way in which you give them their place, their pleasure, and then we let them go. And I think that is possible. I think we can do it. And I think, again, it's about a practice and cultivating it as an attitude. And I don't think there's anything wrong in the desire to have it again, as long as it doesn't become a dissatisfying compulsion to do so. And again, this is something I practice. And, yeah, and I as I said in the book, I call it the virtues of the table, but I don't pretend to be a paradigm of these things. I don't pretend that I have perfected these virtues. But I think that is something I've got better at. I think in the past, you know, if I thought something was nice and tasty, I'd be really, you know, looking forward to the next time I can have it or whatever, or having a bit too much of it when it is there because I don't want to let it go. And I think these days I'm more able to appreciate things while appreciating I can't have it all, I can't do much, and let things go and not be greedily grasping, you know. Yeah. I've even been known to say no to cake recently, which it'd be very hard to have predicted a few years ago.
Well, what you said about the Buddhist abbot, that does sound a bit austere. I think sometimes people think with mindfulness you have to become some sort of detached observing machine rather than, as you say, embracing or engaging with our experience. I quite like the expression, everything in moderation, including moderation. I think it's important to let our let our hair down or splash out sometimes, which you also talk about in your book.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, again, it's part of being human, you know, that we're not here forever. And although, for the most part, you know, we live better lives when we're not simply allowing ourselves to be pulled hither and thither by our immediate desires, I think there is always a time for that kind of, you know, celebration and excess. It's quite interesting that in a lot of great religious traditions, certainly cultural traditions, they kind of allow for that. So carnival, for example, you know, in the Catholic countries, you know, yeah, have all sorts of prohibitions. You know, carnival is this time where they kind of accept that people are going to go a little bit crazy.
Yeah. You also mentioned that wonderful film in the book, Babette's Feast, which sort of, I think, exemplifies that quite well.
Yeah, Babette's Feast is actually a fantastic film. Very interestingly, it was by the current Pope, before he became Pope, actually in an interview said it was one of his favourite films, which puzzles a lot of people because it seems to be, on the face of it, superficially at least, a kind of critique of that kind of austere religion and an embrace of something more secular. But I think what the film shows rather beautifully is there's not really a profound tension between the religious impulse and the secular impulse. It's all about, you know, an attitude of reverence and of celebration and of, or, you know, thinking of others, the way in which, you know, Babette, actually, she creates this feast, but she spends her entire fortune to give this thing to others. And what she gets out of it in return is the ability to express her creativity, which, as a kind of artist, she likes to do, and she feels she needs to do. So again, you know, I think it's quite right that if you approach even kind of massive celebration and what might be thought of as excess, if approached in the right spirit, can be part of the rich fabric of a life well lived.
Yeah. Okay. Okay then, what is your understanding of the middle way, Julian, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of the middle way is reasonably limited. I know a little bit about Robert Ellis actually wrote a couple of pieces for the Philosopher's Magazine in its early days for us, and which I'm very grateful for. I mean, I find myself sympathetic with a lot of the broad thrust of it, because I think primarily because I come up from a similar place from an Aristotelian side, really, yeah, which is, you know, I do think a lot of the time this idea of the mean is very appropriate. And also, you know, Aristotle also famously said, the quote of his, which I repeat ad nauseam, is that this is a mark of the trained mind only to expect that degree of precision which each subject matter allows.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to be very rigorous in mathematics, but you have to accept a certain amount of unclarity, vagueness even, in things like ethics. So I'm very sympathetic to the broad thrust of it. And I think the question mark I have, and it's a genuine question rather than a fully formed criticism, because I wouldn't pretend to know enough to criticise it, is that it seems to me, yeah, that the spirit of the middle way is very much one which is against dogmatism.
Yeah.
And it has an inherently open-minded attitude. And I would be a bit concerned if, in an attempt to kind of beef up what this middle way means, it kind of ends up becoming ossified in its own kind of set system. Do you see what I mean? It's replacing, it becomes, and the idea of an open-minded dogma is, of course, not a contradiction. We can see that a lot of the time. A kind of certain forms of relativism are like this, you know, where you must not be judgmental becomes the ultimate judgment. So my hope would be, I think it's very worthwhile. I think it's great that people are looking into it. I just hope people don't try too hard to turn it into too much of a thing and see it instead as a kind of a broad kind of attitude and family of approaches which can be, you know, sympathetic to one another.
Yeah, well, I hope that is the case. I mean, I think it is something that you should be always aware of with anything like this, that you know you can hold it too rigidly. And so we really try to see it as something as a work in progress, and also that it's something that also, you know, it doesn't have any end goals or anything, and it's also something that everyone can contribute to. And I think, I suppose the other thing is that it's not just a concept. You mentioned earlier on about a practice. I mean, the middle way is as much a practice of cultivating this sensibility of provisionality, of avoiding getting stuck, basically. And so that's something that you you know, so there's that psychological aspect to Hobbit too. But I do appreciate your point, and there's always that danger.
Yeah, and I think another thing about it, which is a positive, is, as I understand it, partly what's being done with the creation of the society, is that you're creating a kind of community of like-minded people. And I think that can be very important as well, actually, that, you know, people who have, you know, not so similar as to become, you know, narrow-minded and sort of like mutually reinforcing, but yeah. People have a genuine inquiring spirit, but enough of a sufficient interest that they can relate to each other, having the opportunity to talk about these things with each other. Because, you know, I think it's very difficult for doing any kind of philosophical thinking is very difficult. And it's very difficult to do it by yourself, despite the image of the philosopher as the solitary person sitting in the garret, whatever it might be. I mean, I think that, you know, I know from experience that really what really helps you push your thinking forward is critical but sympathetic friends. And hopefully you're developing a community here whereby people can really, you know, push each other and help each other to sort of grow.
Well, thank you very much for those supporting words. I mean, that is certainly our intention. And, we're slowly but gradually forming a community. We have lots of discussions on the site, and we meet regularly for retreats, etc. And we certainly do not agree on everything. It's more the approach rather than the content of what we're talking about, which I find really stimulating. But I also find that very much with your work. I mean, I don't agree with everything you say, Julian, which I'm sure you wouldn't want me to. But
No, it'd be a bit scary if you find someone who agree. I don't sure I entirely agree with myself, let alone other people entirely agree with me.
Yeah, but it's your approach that I find very interesting, and I see a lot of congruence with your outlook and your approach to the middle ways too. But anyway, just my last question. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, the one-stop shop is, I guess, my website, which is microphilosophy.net. And everything you need to know, and a whole lot more, no doubt, will be up there or findable from there.
Okay, brilliant. Anyway, it's been great to talk to you today, Julian. It's been a lot of fun for me too.
Me too, Barry. Thank you very much.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.